Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. The guest speaker will be retiring director of Omaha's Henry Dorley Zoo and chairman of the Omaha Zoo Foundation, Lee Simmons. He'll talk about his accomplishments during his tenure as zoo director and his next assignment, fundraising for exhibit expansion and endowment growth. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, February 19, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Gary Willis, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Years ago, my church that I belonged to, we used to have picnics in the old Riverview Park. The younger ones would venture off and we would make a trip over to the zoo. And I remember the setup quite well, the way it was. There was a monkey cage, there was a field that bison would roam around, there was a tiger cage, and a cage for polar bears. And that was the old Riverview Zoo, I believe. Today we have a world-class zoo with exhibits that are as close as possible to the animal's natural environment. Today we are honored to have Dr. Lee Simmons here with us today, who recently announced his retirement as zoo director and will continue his role as fundraiser for the zoo. Dr. Simmons?
Thank you very much. I tend to wander around a little bit, kind of like like an old steer, a point here, a point there, and sometimes not a lot in between. So, and certainly we'll cut off in time to answer any questions. And kind of reminiscing back, a little over 42 years ago, when Marie and I first came to town, there were 10 employees at the zoo. And we had a budget of $100,000. And today, of course, and then by the time I became director 3.5 years later, we were up to a total of like 14 employees. So we were really going big time by then. And today we've got 260 full-time year-round, about another 40 part-time year-round. And then in the summer, we get to 625, 600, and some summers we've gotten up close to 650 employees, most of whom are high school and college students that work in the summer for us. And anyway, and that the first year that I became director, our total budget was $350,000 in 1970, and of course our budget today is somewhere north of about $23 million. So we've made a bit of progress. You just give you a little measuring stick to measure by some of the things that have happened. We had when I came to the zoo, we had 350 animals. In about 100 species, about 100 different types of animals, and there was about 350 animals total. And now we've got about 7,000 animals of about 660 species. That's if you don't count the fish and the insects. If you count the fish and the insects, why then we get 14, maybe 15,000 animals and well over 1,000 species, and even that is not counting all the fish we've got down in our big lagoon. So we've grown a bit, and you have to say that of course the reason we've grown is that Omaha is really a very unique and special community, in that a couple of times a year I get to compare notes with colleagues around the country and around the world. And from the standpoint of generosity, as far as supporting things and giving, the Omaha community outdoes, I think, every other major city in the United States for those things that it believes in. And it's not limited just to the zoo. I think the Omaha community supports its institutions better than certainly any of the big city. And then if you talk to our European colleagues about charitable donations, they don't really understand what you're talking about. It's just kind of a blank puzzle because they're all governmental zoos and they don't get any governmental they get all governmental help. They don't get private sector help. And the guys in the UK a little bit, but and because of that generosity, we've been able to do. Not only have we grown the zoo from being a summertime 7 month zoo, because when I first started here, we were only open 7 months out of the year, and then it was quite a few years after, several years after I became director, that we finally got one building that was heated in the winter, so that if somebody came and it was snowing out, there was a place that they could go in and get warm in, and so then we became a year-round zoo, at least in name, and of course now you can come and spend a half a day or three quarters of a day or a whole day and stay inside the whole time. Of course, then we got foolish and air-conditioned some of our buildings and then built some buildings that, like the Desert Dome, that absolutely need air conditioning if you're going to have anybody in them in the summertime. And so we're, I think the public likes us, but OPPD sure likes us too. When you start dealing with the passive solar gain from a 2-acre plexiglass roof, it puts a smile on their face that you couldn't take off with sandpaper. It's our electric bill is about five times what. Well, no, it's about our electric bill is about 15 times what our budget when I came here, that the budget was just for the electricity. So anyway, we've done, and because of this, the public and our support, the business community and private individuals, we've been able to do a lot of kind of cutting edge, state of the art, world class exhibits. And the first one that really fell into that category was the Lead Jungle. And it was, when we built it, the largest total immersion exhibit of its kind in the world. And it's only been about 3 years ago that finally that got eclipsed, when another rogue veterinarian and a good friend of mine deliberately built a building in Zurich, Switzerland, that's bigger. But they don't have the trees and the planting. It'll take them another 10 years to get the ambiance that we've got in the Lead Jungle. And then the other really kind of big world-class exhibits that we've done have been the aquarium and the Desert Dome and Kingdoms of the Night and Gorilla Valley and the fun of doing things like that is you can't just simply decide, because we do all of our own conceptual design and a lot of our planning and design kind of in-house and in-town using a local architect, as opposed to bringing in a hired gun from out of town who's probably going to sell you something that he's sold three or four times before. We do everything in-house, and so that means that every time you do a new exhibit, you have to go back to school and decide what animals you're going to have and how you're going to display them and look at the natural history of the animals so that you've got an idea about what you're going to feed them and how you're going to feed them and take care of them and what happens if they breed and have babies, which everybody hopes for, and how do you take care of the babies. And we have a little game we call the What If game, which is basically a game in which we, after we've kind of got our conceptual ideas together and something on paper, we bring everybody together that will have anything to do with that building, even including you know, the guy that's got to take the garbage out, and let them kind of go through and sharpshoot. They don't get to vote, but they get to sharpshoot and say anything they want as long as they come up with a, and this is wrong, this won't work, but here's, you know, here's the solution. This will make it work. And it's kind of, it's the game, the what-if game is designed to outwit Murphy, because as we all know, Murphy still rules most of the world. And Murphy still, as Doug Armstrong can tell you, bites you in the ass every now and then, except with Doug it was the arm and not the other part of him. But that's what makes, you know, that's what makes things fun, is to kind of go back to school, sit down, and people are always asking me, what's your favorite exhibit? And the favorite exhibit is always the exhibit that you're either doing or you're about to do, because that's the one that's the challenge. You know, you tend to have some animals that you like better than other animals, but your favorite exhibit is always the one that you're either doing and solving problems for or are about to. Anyway, the thing that I think is probably best about Omaha, in, you know, in addition to the fact that we built a lot of very big world class and cutting edge exhibits, is that with our governance and with the community, we've had a lot of freedom of action to pursue areas of conservation and work in areas, in just about any area that we wanted. So there, you know, the net result is that we've developed a lot of conservation programs all around the world. I was in looking at the map the other day. We've got a map, big map with pins all over it. And I think, if I counted right, that there were 41 countries that had pins in them, some of them multiple pins, where there were many, many pins, because we had done many, many projects or programs in those countries. And the zoo world has shifted, in that zoos used to really only worry about what was inside their chain-link fence, and maybe working with a few other zoos around the country. And zoos have shifted now to the point that we're really concerned with what's happening in the wild, what's happening with habitat, what's happening with species in the wild. One of the big pushes right now in the zoo world, not only in the zoo world, but in Omaha, and part of the reason that we've got that big number, when I say we've got 14, nearly 15,000 animals, if you include everything, is that we've got one of the world's biggest collections of amphibians, of frogs and salamanders and newts and all right now, because one-third to one-half of all of the amphibians in the world are probably going to become extinct because of a fungus that has spread all the way around the world. And so the zoo world is trying to combat that, partly by bringing critically endangered species into captivity, treating them for the fungus, and then simply holding them as assurance colonies, you know, as kind of a what's the word, the safety net, so that when we finally figure out how to combat the fungus, maybe we can reintroduce them back into the wild. One of the things that people are playing with, that, you know, cross your fingers, we're kind of hoping, is that it turns out some amphibians are immune to the fungus, and it turns out that maybe the reason some of them are immune is that they've got a bacteria on their skin that combats the fungus. So we're kind of, this is putting it a little bit crudely, but we're trying to take some of the ones that aren't immune and the ones that are immune and kind of rub them together, and and see if we can transfer the bacteria. We're doing a little bit more scientifically than that, but anyway, and so we're concerned with a lot of, you know, with a lot of different things. When I first came here, you know, the total medical resources that we had was one little brown panda bag, about so big, little leather bag, panda bag, you know, like the old country doctor used to carry when he came to make a house call. And I opened it up, had one bottle of penicillin in it, and a handful of surgical instruments, and probably 25 or 30 cockroaches that crawled out of it. So it wasn't a very good start. And of course now we've got state of the art facilities. We're doing not only a lot of clinical medicine and teaching clinical medicine, because we take interns, and so we take interns every year. We also take we take about 150 students a year, which I think, in addition to the main function, people think that, you know, the main function of a zoo is to build another lead jungle or another desert dome or kingdoms of the night or something. And certainly from the general public standpoint, those things are very, very important, to do big cutting-edge exhibits, because that's what brings people in and pays the gas and electric bill. But from the zoo world standpoint, probably shaping public opinion on conservation issues and ethics and the plight of animals and of the animals' habitat in nature is more important, and probably as important to that is educating kids, is exposing, taking a kid that's already got the aptitude, that already has the drive, and expose them to the zoo world and to the natural world, and hopefully some of those kids will catch fire and develop a fire in their belly and go on and do something useful. So we take about 150 students a year. From about half of them are U.S., and about half of them are from overseas. About half of them are undergraduates, and about half of them are graduate students working on either a master's or a PhD or sometimes a postdoctorate. They stay from anywhere from a 2 or 3 week stay for some of the short ones to a year or a year and a half for the students that stay longer. And we've actually got housing on the zoo grounds. We've got two dormitories and four student houses that nobody knows about. Nobody knows that we actually run a little hotel. Sometimes it gets a little interesting. We had a fellow from Brazil who we had to go in and put a little program on the internet once that said, if you go to those kind of websites, we're going to throw you out and send you home. But the result is that as these students come, do their thing, do their projects at the zoo, and then go back home, and then hopefully get involved in conservation, they drag us into projects. So we've worked in 41 countries. Marie and I have actually traveled and worked in 33 countries ourselves, plus Antarctica. And so, you know, we've been to some pretty neat places and consulted with on improving zoos in places like Budapest and Rome. But we've also been in some places that weren't quite so neat, like, you know, in Laos and Vietnam and Malaysia and Borneo, and so that's, you know, that's kind of one of the side benefits of being a zoo director is you get to travel a lot, see a lot, do a lot, and And we're involved in a lot of projects, both both medical research projects. We send probably on an average of once, sometimes twice a year, we send a team to somewhere to do instruction in frequently it's Far Eastern Russia or it's China or it's Indonesia or Vietnam, number of places, because you can only bring so many students to the United States. But if you send a team, a teaching team, to both demonstrate and teach, why then instead of being able to bring 10 Russians or Vietnamese or Indonesians into Omaha to put them through an intensive course of study, you can go and spend a couple of weeks and touch maybe 100 people. And so we do a lot of that kind of thing. Some of the projects that we're involved with, we've got, in addition to our clinical medicine, we've got a lot of medical research. We've got reproductive research that we're involved with, genetic research, nutritional research, and we've also got a rare plant lab. It's the only rare plant lab in any zoo in North America. In fact, our rare plant lab is something that not even the Missouri Botanical Gardens down in St. Louis has. So we've kind of a leading cutting edge facility in the world. We actually turn out more product out of our rare plant lab than Kew Garden does in England, and that's the biggest facility of its kind in the world. And some of the projects that we're working on, I touched a little bit on the frogs and amphibians and all, but we're working right now, just to kind of give you a bit of a spectrum, we're working on a vaccine for canine distemper, which is the viral disease that dogs can get if they're not vaccinated, in lions, because canine distemper made the jump from native dogs into lions a number of years ago in places like Tanzania and South Africa, and just literally wiped out hundreds and hundreds and thousands of lions that simply died of a disease they had no immunity for. We're doing a hearing study in tigers, and you saw a little bit of that in the press recently. We found out that tigers hear at ultra, ultra low frequencies below the what humans can hear, that they can probably communicate at 5 or 6 miles. And that explains some anecdotal stuff that the tiger researchers in the wild, particularly in places like Indonesia, where they have these big wildfires that sweep through, and all of a sudden in an area that is only got room for 50 or 60 tigers, there's 200 tigers, and you wonder why these guys don't completely destroy each other. And apparently there's some communication mechanisms and all that they can come in, and for a short period of time during the fire, they turn from being very solitary and fiercely defending territory to, all right, we'll just, we'll let all these other guys in. Some interesting things out there, and we think maybe if we can figure this all out, we might be able to do recordings that says you can play a recording of a tiger that's bigger and tougher than any tiger in the whole territory, next to a village or so the tigers don't come in and carry off cows and goats and kids. Actually, in some cultures, where the government compensates you for tiger predation, you get a lot more for your cow than you do for having a kid carried off. We're involved in a project that we've gotten three, maybe I think we're about to get our fourth patent issued on it. for disinfecting semen. Started a number of years ago when I wanted a way to bring in sperm samples from Africa, where they have hoof and mouth and rinderpest, and therefore it's very difficult because these are diseases that would decimate our cattle population here. And so we started working on a way to disinfect, to remove the viral particles and the bacterial particles from semen without killing the semen, because we want to do artificial insemination. I'm not sure we'll ever get that done, but as it turns out, it's taken a funny hop in that it turns out to probably be very, very useful, because it's so far, knock on wood, it seems to be 100% effective. And we've got 3 patents on it already. For humans with HIV and hepatitis. So, that's one of the things that we're working on. Mentioned our rare plant lab. Marge Fromm has got right now. I was in the growing room here a while back and asked Marge how many orchids. We're doing a lot of work. We've been working for about 11 years in Madagascar on our genetics programs. And as a spinoff to that, all of the orchids in Madagascar are considered rare and in danger of extinction. So we begin to catalog and look at orchids and photograph orchids when they were in bloom, and then come back later and collect seeds, and then work with, can you store these seeds in liquid nitrogen so that 50 or 100 years from now, you could come back in and restart it. You could have orchids that are very rare today that went completely extinct, and you could come back in 50 or 100 years or even 10 years and restart them. And it turns out you can freeze them in liquid nitrogen. And so we've got a whole big seed bank frozen in liquid nitrogen. But Marge has also got growing there. In our growing room, somewhere north of 300,000 baby orchids, all about this tall in flasks, probably about 50,000 rare ferns that are from 2 different species of ferns in Bermuda. Nearly all of the orchids are from Madagascar, although we do have one group of orchids that is from a single plant in which there's only 3 plants left in the world, and that plant was from China, and there's only 3 plants left in the whole world, which means that for all intents and purposes, it is extinct because you can't restart it. And I think Marge has got about 450, maybe 500 of those plants. And then if we grow those up and get seed from them, then we can expand it. We're doing it not by cloning. We're doing it all with seed, because you preserve the genetic diversity. And then, of course, our biggest project right now is the genetics project that we've got going on in Madagascar, which has branched out and taken some interesting hops in that Dr. Ed Lewis and his group have discovered and named 22 new species of lemurs, and also upgraded a few other species that already had been named but probably weren't named exactly right or weren't recognized as full species. And happily, I'd say put a spike in a couple of other researchers around the world. I mean, there's only one thing that's maybe better than discovering something new, and that's discovering something that another researcher has done that's wrong. putting a spike in somebody who got it wrong is that's kind of part of the scientific world. That's just about as good as finding something new yourself. But in addition to that, we've branched out into a very big education program in Madagascar. Everybody knows about conservation and preservation of species in the United States, but in a place like Madagascar, where people really struggling. It's perhaps the poorest country in the world. They're really struggling to have enough to eat. And so, you know, if they poach a rare and endangered species and put it in a stew pot, you say it's kind of hard to blame them. Unless they understand and know that they're talking about maybe causing an animal to disappear off the face of the earth. So we've embarked on an education program in the schools there, and I'm happy to say it's working very, very well. In one area where we had a lot of poaching, the poaching has virtually stopped, period. And we, this last year, distributed 15,000 packets of school materials, along with a book and with coloring books and all, and explaining that these animals are their heritage, that these animals belong to them and are really important to their culture, and you shouldn't eat them. You shouldn't eat them, and happily it's worked. And then, of course, the other area that we're working on in is a lot in now is nutrition. We're not only working on diets for elephants and giraffe and lions and tigers and things, but we're working on giraffes, on diets for animals that only eat insects. And then, because that's a little bit difficult in captivity sometimes, we're actually working on diets for the insects that those animals eat, because it turns out that, you know, crickets, if you're feeding frogs crickets, that's kind of like having a diet that consists solely of white bread and lettuce. You know, you're not going to do well. So now we've got a diet that means that the cricket is full of all kinds of good protein and vitamins and minerals. Of course, granted, in order to get that super nutritious meal, he then ends up as kind of the last meal for some frog. But frogs swallow real quick, you know, so it's over in a minute. But we're doing a lot of things like that. And I probably should get on to, we've got, you know, everybody knows about some of our future projects or some of them, but the big project that everybody knows about is that ultimately we'll take over the Rosenblatt Stadium, and people keep asking, what are you going to do with that? And we're going to tear it down and make a parking lot out of it, because that'll free up land over on the other side of 10th Street for some of the exhibits. And we've got about 10 projects that we haven't started yet that we want to accomplish in the next 10 to 12 years. We're working on, I saw them drilling we're about the last three holes on getting our big ski lift, our chairlift done, at least getting the holes in the ground for the foundations. And we're working on that, and we want to open that this spring. And then we're already working on a big Madagascar. It'll be the biggest Madagascar exhibit in the world. Well, take it back. They've named that big botanical building in Zurich, Switzerland, after an area in Madagascar. So I lied to you for a half a minute there. It'll be the biggest Madagascar exhibit in North America. How's that? And which we want to open in 2010, and then we've got another 10 projects that we would like to do. Among which are a couple of really biggies. An elephant facility that would hold maybe 10 or 12 elephants, which means that sometime here in the future, once that gets rolling, then we got to rent a 747, fly to southern Africa, fill it full of about 12 teenage elephants in a 747, and then you hope they don't sway in unison while you come back. And then a very big Arctic, another really critically endangered habitat is the Arctic, and we want to do a very big Arctic exhibit with walrus and polar bears and sea otters and seals and giant spider crabs. There's an animal I've always been fascinated with. A giant spider crab can get to be 12 feet from tip to tip. And so it takes a pretty good size. We built a spider crab tank in the old aquarium, and we never did get around to using it for spider crabs. Now we want to build a spider crab that would hold really big spider crabs. And so I should probably break off here a little bit if we've got some questions to answer. We're not doing too badly here. And I'll do my best to answer whatever questions you've got.
Okay. The first question, are any giant pandas in the zoo's future? We had a lot of questions on that one.
Well, you never know, because it is the Chinese, and giant pandas with the Chinese is strictly political. It has nothing to do with the conservation of the animals, because we had a lot to offer, and we were offering a lot. And we actually put a lot of effort and time and effort and money into the Chinese giant panda program and in trying to bring them here. But it's all political. And the last thing, well, not the last thing, because about a month ago I got word from three different people that the Minister of Foreign Affairs said, don't give up. You know, don't give up. We're still going to send you pandas. And I'll believe that the day that pandas arrive. It's all political. The reason we've kind of backed away and you're not hearing us say much about pandas is the Chinese just kept asking for more and more and more and more, and then the last thing that happened is they demanded that we stop Governor Heinemann from going to Taiwan on the trade mission. They didn't just demand it. They demanded it with some pretty stiff threats of what would happen if we didn't stop him, and that's a little bit outrageous. So we just kind of backed off and moved on to other things.
Could you give a comment regarding teenage chimps or other exotic animals as house pets?
Absolutely not. I started out in my zoo career to be a herpetologist. I mean, the thing that fascinated me was snakes. And then somewhere along the line, and I was working at the reptile house in Oklahoma City in summer, volunteering part-time and in the summer, and decided that maybe I wanted to have something to say about how zoos were run. And herpetologists never get to say much except people that keep the really deadly poisonous snakes and things like chimpanzees and tigers and lions, even though there are more tigers and lions in private hands than there are in zoos, simply shouldn't be allowed to happen, because the number of serious injuries and or fatalities that you get from these animals, because they're still wild animals. There is no such thing as a tame wild animal. And you can have I nearly got eaten by a tiger once that I had raised from the day he was born. That tiger had never known another tiger, never known anything else, had raised him. He was one of the tiger in your tank, humble oil tiger in your tank tigers, you know, and he got to be about 250 pounds and decided to eat me one day. It was nothing that I'd done. It's just something that triggered him. There's no such thing as a tame wild animal, and they either need to be in the wild or in some place that can properly take care of them, because they all ultimately hurt somebody.
What are your thoughts on the debate of global warming as it affects wildlife?
Well, there's no question that global warming is happening. There's absolutely, you know, there's no question. To what degree, I think we're going to have to measure things for another another 20 or 30 years to know just how serious it is, because if you look at the history of the Earth, we've had many, many cycles of global warming. I think we probably are contributing to it with our greenhouse gases and all of that. Are we contributing to it in a really significant manner? I think, again, the jury's still out on that. I think it behooves us, simply because we shouldn't take a chance that we might be pushing the snowball over the edge of the hill. You know, it behooves us to do everything we can to cut down on our emissions and our greenhouse gases, because we could. But I think that there's a whole lot of this rhetoric that the jury is out on. It is affecting wildlife. One of the reasons that we want to do this big Arctic exhibit is that certainly it is affecting and will affect polar bears fairly seriously. It's already affecting walrus seriously. The mortality rate in walrus calves on the Kamchatka Peninsula in Russia has gone way, way up. They don't have, you know, they've got to swim farther. They don't have any place to rest. They don't have any ice to rest on for a lot of the year as they used to. So they've got to rest. They've got to come in and beach. That means that puts a lot more animals on the beaches than really need to be on the beaches, and that means that calves don't survive. There's no question that is affecting wildlife. I think you got to measure it long term to know just how damaging and how dramatic it's going to be. But potentially, if the trend continues, it's going to have a pretty profound effect on some species.
Next question: are there any invasive species threatening the rivers or the land in this area?
Yeah, the grass carp in not, well, I say it, I don't know that the grass carp has invaded the Missouri to any degree, but, you know, there's the grass carp, which is that fish that jumps out of the water and nearly, you know, because they get big, nearly knocks you out of your boat. The walking catfish in Florida, Florida is getting overrun with Burmese pythons that have been brought back from Vietnam and Laos and all by as pets. And then, you know, the problem is you feed them a rat a week and they grow big, and then pretty soon they get to the size that maybe they might look at your kid as something that, and so you got two choices. You can either try to find a home for them, and there's a lot of them. Or you can euthanize them. People don't want to do that for something that's been a pet, so they turn them loose. And they're doing quite well. I mean, they're eating raccoons and getting fat and growing big, and so there's some really big pythons down in Florida now. The African clawed frog, which is the frog that introduced the chytrid fungus that's killing off all of our other frogs and killing off all the salamanders in Appalachia. You know, if you talk about eastern Appalachia and that chain of mountains that goes all the way up the eastern border of the country, we've got some really incredible salamanders in there, and they're disappearing just kind of as we watch. They're disappearing because of this fungus that the African clawed frog. African clawed frog was brought to this country and to virtually every continent in the world, except Antarctica, as a pregnancy test for women, for humans, because that was, you know, they did the frog test first, and then, they did the rabbit test first, then they had the frog test, and then we developed a bench test that was much more accurate, much faster, cheaper, all of that, and so what happened is a bunch of these places that were raising frogs commercially, all of a sudden, you know, now you've got 10,000 frogs and nobody wants to buy them anymore, so they turned them loose. And that's where this chytrid fungus has come from. So, anyway. And there are a lot of plant species, too. But
How instrumental was the zoo in the decision to tear down Rosenblatt Stadium, and how will this affect how will the absence of Rosenblatt affect the zoo attendance?
Well, actually, our attendance will probably go up because our attendance during the 11 days, which is prime season for us, that the College World Series, 11 or 12 days that they're there, our attendance actually falls substantially because there is no parking. We didn't have anything to do at all. We stayed completely out of the fray and neutral as far as the decision to move the stadium down to downtown. We just kind of took a rigid stance that we'd keep our mouths shut and not say anything one way or the other. But once that decision was made, then obviously we had a very big vested interest in not losing that parking. What most people didn't know is most of that paving over there that they parked on during College World Series was paid for by the zoo board anyway, because back in when the NCAA made its first demands on the city about paved parking, the city didn't have any money, and so it was actually members of the zoo board that raised the money to pave those parking lots. And then I kind of like to have to remind the city guys that they their Alzheimer's creeps up on them every now and then. They develop amnesia, but so we've had to remind them of that several times over the years. But without that parking, right now the total parking on zoo property and that property over there is about 2,300 stalls. We'll tear down the stadium, make a parking lot out of that. We pick up about another 950 stalls, and then we'll end up giving up about 400 to maybe 450. So we get a net gain of about 500 stalls. Yeah, when we build the exhibits over on the east side of 10th Street. And so then we end up with a net gain, and on a big day, you know, we fill every one of those stalls two or three times or more. So we can fill on a big zoo day, we fill every stall on our property and on Rosenblatt's property.
You have many things to be proud of. Is there anything that you are most proud of?
Oh, I think our research programs, because we're in some of our programs, we easily rank in the top three or four in the United States. In a couple of our research programs, we are the top, period. You know, we're number one, period, in a couple of the research programs that we're doing. And these are all conservation research. And so, being number one, being the best at something is something that you always like to do and you're proud of. And then I think our education programs, the things that we're doing with students, and it's not just the students that are coming from other parts of the country and from overseas. Yeah, that's really important too. But you know, we've got an all-day kindergarten at the school. At the zoo, rather. We've got, starting about 8 or 9 years ago, we started with 15 Zoo Academy students, and that came 5 days a week for part of a day. Then that group has enlarged to two groups of 18, so there's 36 of them. And next year we'll take on another 70 to 80 full-time Zoo Academy students that will do their junior and senior year at the zoo in a science academy focused primarily on math, science, and with a lot of emphasis on zoology and biology, but they'll do all of their math and their science and English. They'll do everything. Their whole curriculum will happen at the zoo. That'll be another 70 to 80 students. So, you know, by this time next year, we'll have we'll have about 115 or 116 high school students at the zoo every single day. And, you know, somewhere down the line, you know, a few of those kids are going to catch fire and go out and do something useful in the zoo world or in conservation.
Okay, and our last question is, can you give us some anecdotes, things that have happened, funny or serious?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, I once had a letter referred to me from the mayor's office recommending that I be fired, demanding that I be fired, actually. It was the day an orang bit the tip of this finger off and chewed up the rest of my hand pretty good. And there were two little ladies there who saw the whole thing and just kind of ignored the fact that there was kind of blood everywhere and a lot of hollering and keepers trying to beat the orang off of me, and they hit me more than they did the damned orang, and focused on the fact that I apparently must have used a little profanity, and they wanted me fired. In the early days, the mayor didn't take it serious, but in the early days, you know, we didn't have a hospital or a nursery, so we brought all the animals home. So, you know, we had a little bit of everything at home. We had a pair of giant otter cubs, pups, in the bathtub for a while. We had polar bears and leopards. I had about a 10-foot African rock python and a 25-pound leopard living in the house with us until just before my middle daughter was born, and my bride said it's probably time to get rid of them and take them back to the zoo, because the leopard was bringing blood on our 6-year-old son about 7 then, actually. The leopard was bringing blood on him about 3 or 4 times a week, so we figured a newborn baby wouldn't stand up too well. We had at one time 3 kids in diapers, the middle daughter, a baby orang, and a baby gorilla, all taken, all on bottles and all in diapers all at the same time. We've had the opportunity to work in a lot of kind of interesting wild woolly places, and including working in Russia in the winter time. We were in 1978 was Vietnam. In 1978, we were working in the field in Russia. And they brought some bigwigs from Moscow out to watch us work, and we'd already figured out that the Russians, that thing about the Russians liking to drink vodka was not just a rumor, that they did, and you know they and the days were so short, and they would take you into dinner or into lunch, and you never got up from the table hardly. I mean, it was terrible, and so we didn't know exactly who it was that they were bringing out to watch us work. We were in the field up in a place called Pushino up on the Oka River, and we were immobilizing some European bison and some red deer, and about 1 o'clock, they said, you know, we're very impressed, and it's now time to go to the table and have a few drops of liquid. Well, a few drops of liquid means they're going to get just knee-walking drunk. And we just, I mean, we'd been working in the field then for about getting close to 3 weeks, and we just didn't want to go in and get drunk again. And so I said, well, I just got a couple more things I want to show you, and I just selected an animal and said, is it all right to immobilize this animal? And then just kind of cooled. It was a big bison bull, and I just kind of cooled him down so that we could walk around him and handle him. And then we put him down a little bit more and a little bit more, and so we could do more and more things to him. And I just strung it out from about 1 o'clock till about 4 o'clock, which meant that by 4 o'clock it got dark. And all the time we kept all of these guys in their mink hats and their big fur coats standing in the snow, stomping their feet, trying to stay warm. And so they didn't say anything. We were the visitors. We were the guests. And so we got into this dining hall. They took us over to a hunter's cabin, and we were out in the woods. It was 27 below zero at 4 o'clock, and they said, well, they were very impressed, and we had shown them many things that the Russians hadn't been able to do and couldn't do, which was true. The Russians killed most of what they tried to immobilize. And did we think that we could immobilize some Russian wild boars? And pigs are very difficult, and particularly in those days with the drugs we had, pigs were very difficult. We'd been in the country almost 3 weeks. We hadn't killed anything, and the Russians had killed a lot of animals in their immobilization. So we were feeling pretty pumped up and bulletproof, and we said, sure, we can do this. And so they said, well, so they took us out. They gave us a little something to eat, but nothing to drink much. Then they took us out at 6 o'clock and put us up in tree blinds way out in the taiga. And we had no notion about where we were at. They drove us out there, put us up in tree blinds at 6 o'clock, and they left us there till midnight. And, of course, there were no Russian wild boars around there. There wasn't a Russian wild boar in 300 miles of that damn place. They were just getting even with us for making us stand in the snow. We damn near froze to death.
I would like to thank Dr. Simmons for taking time out of his busy schedule to participate in today's forum, and we wish him well on his retirement as zoo director.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. We've heard a talk by retiring director of Omaha's Henry Dorley Zoo, Lee Simmons. He reflected on his accomplishments during his tenure as zoo director, as well as his next assignment, fundraising for exhibit expansion and endowment growth. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, February 19th, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. The next program will be Thursday, March 19th at 12 noon. At that time, we'll hear a debate between the three declared candidates for mayor of Omaha, former mayor Hal Dobb, and current Omaha City Councilman Jim Vocal and Jim Suttle. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete noon forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.